Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
People are a mystery, aren't they? What makes us tick? What makes us pursue different relationships, interests, career, goals, hobbies, religions, whatever? Why are some people really good and others very much not so? What is the human condition as it relates to how we think and how we act? Well, Dr. Mark Leary is a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University, and he teaches a great lecture at the Great Courses Plus called Mysteries of Human Behavior. This is a wonderful exploration into the things that make us human. And it's just one of over 8,000 lectures at the Great Courses Plus on topics ranging from science to religion to history to travel to music, the arts, hobbies, auto repair, how to play chess, and so much more. Unlimited streaming or download to your computer, laptop, tablet, or smartphone. And a wealth of knowledge is at your fingertips. I want you to try the Great Courses Plus, so they are giving my listeners unlimited access to watch all their courses for free for one full month. But you need to sign up with my special URL. So start your free month right now. You'll love it. Sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. It's official. I finally get the chance to speak in New York City. I've been looking forward to this opportunity for a long time, and all the pieces finally came together. It's going to happen Thursday night, September 28th. So just a few weeks away, and I hope you can join us in New York City. Going to be speaking at the SLC Conference Center. I have all the details on that on the events page at thethinkingatheist.com/events. After that, I'll be at the Myth Information Conference. That's the final weekend of this month in Milwaukee. Now, I'm not speaking there. I'm a guest, kind of a red carpet premiere going on for their film Batman and Jesus, plus the Myth Information Conference is going on all day. The weekend of October 20th, Orlando, Florida. It's Florida Free Thought, Free Flow 2017, a big lineup of speakers on the roster, including myself for that weekend. Of course, our attention's been locked in on Florida for the past, I don't know how many days, with Irma and all the devastation that's been going on, and of course, the subsequent recovery and relief efforts. And this is going to go on for a long time. I do encourage you to support many of the organizations on the ground down there, like the Foundation Beyond Belief and others, and let's be a part of the solutions for Florida. But we're still on for October 20th weekend in Orlando, and very much looking forward to that. And I'll be in Wichita the first Sunday in November. All the details on all of these events at thethinkingatheist.com/events, okay? Next week, I'm releasing kind of a 1-2 punch. I've got a short video about my visit to the Ark Encounter. Matt Dillahunty and I toured the Ark Encounter together. I got some photos and video, and I've got a kind of a, it's a 7-minute piece, 7 or 8 minutes. I'm still finishing the production of it. It's going to release to YouTube next week. And then I think we're going to get together with Matt Dillahunty and then also Aaron Raw, who has toured the Ark Encounter. And the three of us are just going to chat about much of what we saw. And that'll be a podcast. So I've got the video and the podcast both scheduled for next week. And, if nothing else, I found it entertaining. You know, it's really the comedy event of the year. And it's also a tremendous tragedy, if you know what I mean. The audio and video will show you exactly what I'm talking about early next week, okay? Today's show is about the millennial. We'll talk about the secular millennial, the godless millennial. We'll talk about the label, the generation in question. I'm going to continue to use the term for the purposes of this broadcast because it's a helpful framework for this particular generation. I realize I'm an almost 50-year-old guy. that brings my own biases to the conversation. For those who think I'm about to use millennial as some kind of insult throughout the broadcast, just relax. Okay, just relax. You're in good hands. You're in fair hands. I mean, I'll be the first to say that I have bumped into people and found myself talking a little bit like my parents and grandparents, these kids today. You know, these helicopter parents, all they did was coddle and pat their kids on the head and give them participation medals for showing up, even if they got crappy grades. And they were taught that the whole universe revolves around them and they live an entitled life and have an attitude of instant expectation without doing any work and zero problem solving skills. And they just show up and wonder why the world doesn't care that life isn't fair and blah, 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 blah. Yeah, you know what? Those people exist. Those people exist. And you know what else? They existed during my generation. And they existed in the generation before that and the generation before that. We might have found it a bit easier to label them. And I know we can find examples of them, but there is nothing new under the sun. So if I occasionally jab at or tweak somebody under the brand millennial, please know that I'm fully aware that many of these people existed when I was growing up and when our parents were growing up, okay? So don't take it personally. Don't flip out. Don't write me angry emails. Trust me, my goal is to spend most of this broadcast talking to millennials and getting their perspective about their own generation. And with that in mind, I'm going to go right now directly to the phones and do that very thing. Area code 503, you are on the Thinking Atheist Radio podcast. What's your name?
Hi, my name's Madison.
Madison, we're talking about millennials. Are you one?
Yes, I am.
Do you hate the term millennial?
Yes, I very much so. I feel like people tend to use it to alienate the younger generation and kind of use it to dismiss people.
That's fair. How old are you, may I ask?
I'm 25 years old.
What's your take on this generation, right? I'm talking like my parents, forgive me, Madison. Like these young people today, I'm trying to avoid that. What are people so often misunderstanding about, you know, the people who are of your age bracket, your generation?
Well, I mean, I feel like every generation has their issues and people tend to point ours out a lot. But I think there's a lot of good coming from the millennial generation. We were born with a lot of information at our fingertips, which sometimes I think annoys the older generation because we act as if we know things. However, sometimes we do. But I feel like we kind of have grown up in a situation that's completely different than anybody in history has ever grown up in, where we are very familiar with other cultures, not only on like a media level, but also with like YouTube and social media, things like that. We can actually have communication with young people our own age in certain cultures, even in countries that are in the midst of war. We can communicate with them and kind of see their perspective. And not only that, we have like this emotional connection that we can actually make with people instead of just seeing them as numbers or faces on the news or things like that. We can actually go in there, get to know like what it's like to live in those countries or to live in certain areas or to have certain conflict. And we can actually communicate with them almost like a face-to-face basis in a way.
How does your generation then feel about religion? Let's paint with a broad brush and just talk to me about some of the observations you see.
I definitely think that there is a big difference between the way that millennials view religion and pretty much every generation before us. We have, like I mentioned before, we have a lot of information at our fingertips. We have a lot of different anecdotal evidence, but we also have a lot of access to different things that are going on in the government, different injustices that are happening. There's a lot of voices speaking about the hypocrisy in the different religious texts. We have a lot of very famous YouTubers that speak about atheism and secular rights, especially in education. And as far as like the ability to kind of be treated as a person, because in the past, a lot of the time people would kind of view you as evil demons being dismissed because of your religious lack of belief. And nowadays, I feel like we're able to look around and kind of see that there are actually people like us. Like for me, I was raised in a very Christian family. I actually was the most devout, I would say. I actually dragged my family to church every Sunday. I went every Wednesday. And so when I first came out, I was really uneasy and I didn't want to use the word atheist. I didn't want to depart from that religion aspect of my life due to the fear that I had. I felt like I was alone. I felt like nobody really understood. The only atheists I really saw were the ones that were, you know, Christian haters that were going around just antagonizing. So when I found YouTube, which is how I found your show, actually, I found your show and multiple others, it really opened my eyes to the fact that you can be atheist, but that doesn't mean that's all you are. But that's a part of your person, but you can still be anything you want to be, and it does not define you. You can still be a good person. And that was something that I think wasn't really told to me in the church. So leaving the church, it was something I kind of had to find on my own. And due to the availability on the internet, it really just helped me to see that.
Madison, help me out. I mean, with you and your friends, do you feel like you're less judgmental than the generation of your parents and grandparents? Because I seem to see that. They don't flip out about all the stuff that my parents and even my generation used to freak out about, be it gay marriage or anything else. They seem very engaged with social causes and accepting people as they are. Do you see that?
Yeah, I definitely see that. I think that generally that's true. I think there are some people that, of course, have some issues, but if they do have the issues, they keep it to themselves. They don't feel the need to force others to be as they are. Generally, people just, you know, live and let live, kind of just agree to disagree, anything that you have. And we kind of just recognize how many people are on this earth. And I think we're very aware of that.
If you were to educate then I'll include myself, the 49 and older crowd, about millennials in a nutshell, what would you like us to hear? What would you like us to know?
I think just sitting down and speaking with millennials is important, and going into the conversation without any preconceived notions, I think on both sides, is always good to just hear someone out for who they are and don't judge them before they start speaking. And you'll come to find out that really all the things that we fight about are very superficial, and speaking to the right people, you'll really see that you can communicate and actually come to a consensus on a lot of different issues.
I should let you host the show, Madison. You're good. You're just good at communicating. I appreciate your perspective so very much. It is wonderful to have you on the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time, okay?
All right. Thank you so much, Seth.
Got an email from Scott. He says, this may make me a horrible person, but even though I transitioned from agnostic to atheist years ago, I still work part-time as a church organist. Pipe organ was my primary instrument for my music degree, and I don't know of any other gig where I can make as much extra cash in under 5 hours a week, so I'm going to stick it out for a while longer, at least. I write because you mentioned millennials at the end of the week's podcast, and like most mainline Protestant churches, the church where I work is constantly talking about attracting more millennials. The trouble is, on any given Sunday, I am the only millennial in the building, and that's only because I'm on the payroll. As part of this effort to attract more youth, they recently spent tens of thousands of dollars on a video system with two 80-inch monitors displaying PowerPoint presentations throughout the service. Shockingly, they haven't had 20 and 30-somethings banging down the doors as a result. Another recent attempt involved free food. For weeks, they promoted a fellowship event, and he says, I hate the word fellowship, in which millennials were supposed to come to the church hall one evening for pizza and, quote, resource packets, whatever they are. I did not attend, and reportedly neither did any other millennials. About a half dozen church members did show up for pizza and to pick up a resource packet to bring back to their grandchildren. There is also the classic church community outreach attempt, the pancake breakfast. All are welcome, and the hope is that people show up for pancakes and come back to church the next day. These breakfasts are always on a Saturday, like 9 a.m. to noon. I told them that zero young people are going to set an alarm on a Saturday morning to show up for pancakes at dawn, as I call it. And that instead they should change the menu to Eggs Benedict and mimosas and start at 1 p.m. For that, I might show up. You'd think they would take the advice of the lone member of the generation they so desperately want to attract, but no dice. I also don't attend pancakes at dawn, but I'm told attendees usually include the same white-haired crowd as usual. Anyway, I didn't mean to write such a long email. But besides the bi-monthly direct deposit, the reason I still keep this job is for the entertainment value of these sad, failed efforts to lure in young people. Okay, I'm definitely a horrible person, right? Nah, a buck is a buck. Best regards, Scott. Scott, thanks for the message. That pancake breakfast sounds like something they'd pitch to the seniors. I've got area code 515. You're on the Thinking Atheist radio podcast. Who is this?
This is Grant.
Hi, Grant. We're doing a show about millennials. Everybody has a chance to sound off. What do you think?
I think one of the biggest reasons that millennials are, we're seeing a higher growth in millennials being atheists is just the fact that we have such a wealth of access to information these days. You know, being able to get any sort of information or answers to any of our questions immediately, it really seems silly when we don't have concrete answers and have to just take things on faith.
How do you feel about the generation in terms of how other people often describe it? They're entitled, over-insulated, you know, those types of things. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I definitely think there's a different outlook that we have as far as, you know, the way that we see the world versus previous generations see the world. You know, our parents kind of grew up with, kind of like I said, a lack of information and the way they were taught to see the world versus ourselves, you know, having more access to kind of worldly knowledge and the way that other people are seeing. And we're able to see differences of opinions better.
It is interesting to note just at my age bracket, how much more people at, you know, the age of 18, 20, 25 seem to know than I knew, how much more information is at their fingertips, how in some ways they are so much less naive than we were many years ago. You know, they're often labeled as sort of these coddled, insulated people, but I find them in some instances, many instances, they know a lot more than we did at this age growing up. I don't know. Does that strike you at all? I mean, you feel like you've got more tools in the tool belt at your age than others did?
Definitely. When my mother first found out that I was an atheist, she found a Christopher Hitchens book in my bedroom, and she pulled me aside one afternoon and asked me about it and asked if it meant I was communist. And she's in her 50s, and so to her that was a valid question. It was, you know, she didn't just have a fully understanding of what communism is or what atheism is or how they tie together, or how they don't tie together. So, you know, I guess at that point I got to have a conversation with her and say, you know, let's define these terms. Let's see what your fears are and, you know, how we can kind of have a good relationship going forward.
Can I ask you how old you are?
I'm 23.
I'm trying to picture your mom's generation. Like our grandparents' generation often would tie communism with the worst evil they could think of. Like,
exactly.
You know, whatever's evil, let's link that to communism. And so atheism would be a natural step. It's sort of odd that your mom, who was more of a Generation Xer, I would assume, would do that very thing. Do you have any thoughts on why more and more millennials are godless or uninterested in religion? I mean, do you think we always come back to the internet in that case or what?
Well, I was thinking about it, you know, kind of, you know, my mom, when I was speaking with her about kind of her faith and things like that, you know, even she had pointed out that she doesn't like churches per se. She thinks that they try to be controlling and things like that, but she usually ends up turning back to the faith that churches are pushing. And I think a lot of that has to do, you know, I got into religion a lot when I was about 15 and religion was very important to me. But when I ended up, you know, kind of falling out of that and deconverting, you know, I was only given up about 4 to 5 years of true faith. But when I looked at someone like my parents who, you know, when you're trying to talk them out of it, they'd have to be giving up 50 years or saying for the last 50 years, you know, I've been wrong. The way I've been living my life is wrong. And I think that's harder to do than it is for someone younger like me who can, you know, look at the information that we have available and talk myself out of that.
I'm reminded of that quote by Daniel Dennett, the philosopher, when he said, there's simply no polite way to tell people they've dedicated their lives to an illusion. I mean, if you look at your parents who've been doing this for decades, they become what poker players call pot committed, right? I mean, they've been doing it for so long. They're so vested. that it's even harder for them to walk away from the hand kind of thing, where you, as a younger person, you've got more opportunities and you probably, in some ways, take it a lot less personally. It's less part of the fabric of your life, right?
Exactly, exactly. I think, you know, the idea of her being wrong was very kind of an insult in the way that she's lived her life. And, you know, even though she's not trying to push it or is aggressive in her faith, it's still the way that she was raised, the way her parents taught her, and the way that, you know, she has an outlook on her life.
Grant, does your life have that sense of purpose and work ethic and all the things that some critics say that this generation does not? I mean,
yeah, you know, I think so, definitely. I've got, you know, my fiance and then our dog and our cat, and you know, I just work for a better life, and that's the way that I look at it, and try to just do the best that you can and be a good person. I guess that's the way that I see it.
What's your dog and cat's name?
Dog is Margo, and the cat is Mila.
Margo and Mila.
Yeah.
All right. We'll give him a big scratch from all of us. Okay. And Grant, thanks for sharing your perspective and being a part of this conversation.
Thank you very much, Seth.
Now that we've already talked to a few folks, let's take a second and sort of clear the air and define some stuff. For example, what is a millennial specifically? Well, the definitions vary a little bit, but here's the general idea. Starting with some categories and labels that are going to be helpful for some people, and they're going to drive other people crazy, okay? Generations often have labels which denote them or set them off. Like, people born before 1945 are often known as traditionalists. If you were born between 1946 and 1964, of course, we're talking about the baby boomers. Generation X refers to those born from 1965 to 1976, roughly. The millennials, 1977 to 1995 for their birth date. And Generation Z refers to anybody who was born in 1996 to the present day. Now, what's weird is that these numbers kind of shift around depending on who you talk to. For example, I've usually heard Generation X extends the birthdays into the early 1980s instead of 1976. Generation X, right? That's my generation. Often known as the generation of the latchkey kids, because we apparently had less parental supervision, more and more of our parents, especially the moms, entering the workforce. So we came home and found the key under the mat or wherever, let ourselves in, made ourselves dinner, and waited for mom and dad to get home. We were the MTV generation. Back when music television actually played music, we were the MTV generation. We saw the rise of grunge music and hip-hop and indie movies. And we were called Generation X because apparently our generation was difficult to brand. We were post-baby boomers, and that label didn't apparently catch on. So X became this symbol, a symbol of things that were difficult to define or quantify. The term millennial was actually coined by a couple of historians, Neil Howe and William Strauss. They wrote a book called Generations, which charts out various aspects of American history. And there was an article about him in Forbes explaining that the two chose millennial because they were convinced that this generation would be drastically different than the one before, and they needed a distinct name. And also because many were going to graduate high school on or around the turn of the millennium. The word millennial, it's widely used. Not everybody likes it. Not everybody accepts it. Often because it is seen as an insult. It's a pejorative. It's a derogatory thing. You know, all these millennials. And some people talk about the millennial. They're sneering at people they consider kind of the selfie and Snapchat generation. You know, they're self-absorbed and entitled or too lazy to have a healthy attitude toward other people or careers or problem-solving or proactive living. They show up late for work. When they get there, they kind of drift around on their cell phone all day till quitting time, milking every hour on the clock. Many are financially illiterate and glad to be so. They reject the materialism of their parents and grandparents. Except, of course, when they need the debit card to go out and buy something because they don't have any money themselves. They're seen often as very selfish, the product of being the center of attention, surrounded by their parental cheerleaders who, throughout their short lifetime, showered them with all kinds of accolades for simply being born and being their child. They lived in this sort of barrier of cultural bubble wrap that kept their sensitive skin from ever toughening up so that they could properly face the real world. This is the stereotype. And as is the truth with almost every stereotype, you can find specific examples who are, yes, exactly like this. But here's the thing. You can find those examples inside Generation X and inside the baby boomers and even the traditionalists who came over half a century before. The notion of the lazy millennial is also statistically incorrect. It just doesn't jive with the data. There was a July article on the BBC by Jessica Holland. It's called Why the Millennial Stereotype is Wrong. It references a study by the British think tank, the Resolution Foundation. It reported only one in 25 UK millennials was switching jobs every year in their mid-20s. They had more job stability. In fact, twice the rate of job stability as Generation X. And those millennials who were switching jobs, they enjoyed an average 15% pay raise, which means whenever they were moving from one job to another, it was not a lateral move. It was actually financially advantageous. This makes even more sense when we realize that the millennials are working in a culture where pay raises within specific organizations are on rapid decline. So a job change actually is an opportunity that many of them feel they must take to make more money. This data mirrored in the United States U.S. Department of Labor data. In the year 2015, millennial women accounted for just over 8 in 10 U.S. births. A lot of young families going on, thanks to the millennials. This is according to data from the Pew Research Center. And we are seeing the natural inclination toward financial stability and security that we've seen in previous generations. Those who say that millennials are less interested in buying homes and getting a college education also have to take into account the rising costs of each. Average pay in the workforce for millennials is often too low to allow for much traction. According to CNN, less than 40% of millennial college graduates earn $45,000 a year or more. 20% earn less than 20 grand a year. That's one in five. Student loan payments hamstringing those who are trying to save for housing and raising a family. USA Today published a May 27 article by a guy named William Cummings. It was called The Malignant Myth of the Millennial. And let me just read from a section called Generational Stereotypes. Quote, despite the fuzzy definition, our culture is generally obsessed with generational labels and the stereotypes that go with them, said Jessica Kriegel, author of Unfairly Labeled, How Your Workplace Can Benefit from Ditching Generational Stereotypes. She says, although I'd say that this trend of thinking differently about the younger people in our world has been prevalent for thousands of years, Kriegel said her research found most books, articles, and consultants focused on millennials rely on an oversimplification of human behavior. She also found that they frequently contradict each other. Those contradictions are inevitable because of the diversity within the demographic group. There's about 80 million millennials right now, and some of those millennials are CEOs in Silicon Valley, and some of them are illegal immigrants in the Midwest who are waitressing somewhere. You really can't put them all in a box, and what we do is we put them all in a box, and that box is really based on a middle-income white American person. And then we just say that's the only kind of millennial that exists right now. Take, for example, the stereotype that millennials feel entitled because they were given participation trophies in Little League, even if they didn't necessarily achieve anything special, Kriegel said. Well, you have to have been privileged enough to have been able to afford Little League when you were growing up in order to get that participation trophy. That stereotype also ignores the roughly 7.6 million foreign-born millennials, many of whom never played in Little League at all, she said. The article goes on to assert that the blanket labeling of generations is simply lazy thinking. I will include that article in the description box of this broadcast if you are interested, okay? On Skype, I have Richard. Richard, you're on the Thinking Atheist Radio podcast. How's it going?
Oh, very well, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Richard, we're talking about kind of a hot topic here. We're talking about millennials. It's this weird label that sort of shifts around from year to year. Some people use it as a compliment. Many people use it as kind of an insult. What's your perspective on the millennial?
So to begin with, I didn't realize that I was a millennial until late last year. I'd heard the term bandied around. I didn't really think much of it. And then I did a little bit of research. There's a famous YouTuber that I follow called The Roaming Millennial. And I dug into it a little bit more. and discover what a millennial was, which was someone about my age who graduated around when I did.
Which was when?
I graduated in 2000.
Okay.
I discovered that the particular generation that I'm a part of, the millennials, seem to be a little bit more concerned with feels over facts. So if something feels good, then the facts don't really need to matter. They seem to accept things at face value rather than challenge those ideas. While I say that, there are a fair few exceptions that I'm aware of.
Where do you live?
I'm based in Birmingham in the UK.
Okay. And so when you bump into people of your age bracket, your generation in the UK, you feel that they embrace emotion more than they embrace the specific, the evidence, the factual information. Did I hear that right?
Yes, that would be accurate. So
you realize there are people typing angry emails right now with your name in the subject line. Is Richard is his name, everybody. No, I'm just kidding.
As I say, there are exceptions to the rule, but maybe it's just the circles that I move in that this seems to be the case.
You feel like that this is a generation that has been coddled in some way? Do you feel like it is the snowflake generation?
Yes. I think over here we refer to it more as kind of a nanny state, where everybody will get a prize at school rather than looking at actual achievements, academic performance, and so on, that kind of thing.
Do you think this is the product of what they call helicopter parenting? You know, they were wrapped in sort of a cocoon of isolation and comforts and privilege?
It is a possibility. I'm not sure if privilege does come into it.
Where do you think all this comes from? Where do you think this particular culture, what do you think it's born of?
I think it's to do with the rise of the internet. I think that there's a lot of contrasting ideas that are now available to our generation and the previous generations. Whereas before we used to rely heavily on physically going out and going to libraries to research a subject, we can find that information readily on the internet. And it seems to be a double-edged sword. Whilst there is a good scientific fact out there, there's also a lot of woo. And we seem to find it difficult to distinguish between the woo, the pseudoscience, and the actual science. So rather than offend anybody, it can be a lot easier just to take a step back and say, well, who am I to question what it is that's true or what you believe? A kind of a relativism there.
Do you feel like the millennial generation has been spoon-fed much of what their parents and grandparents had to fight for? And perhaps they take things for granted.
Yes, I would certainly say that there's plenty there that has been taken for granted. Having grown up at the birth of the internet and all the technology that's come along with it and touchscreen phones and vast computers and fantastic gaming machines, everything seems to be available to this generation.
And as such, you think they may not appreciate it as much? As it's like a resource given rather than a resource earned kind of thing? Perhaps they don't see the value in it from your perspective?
Yes. So it's the cost of everything, but the value of nothing. We seem to be told that you are entitled to X, Y, and Z. You'll get prize X, Y, and Z for not doing anything in particular, for not necessarily being the best student, but just turning up. Rather than looking at academic achievement or a meritocracy, as it were.
Do you see some pros to being a millennial? What are a few of the things that you think, hey, you know, it's a great generation to be born in?
Though I have talked about it a couple of times already, the internet is a great resource for anybody to find out anything about any idea, to find like-minded people and to find people whose ideas challenge yours. And that's a particular area that I'm keen on, talking to people whose ideas challenge my ideas so I can learn from them.
So the idea that these millennials are born in an era when they can find almost any piece of information they seek and when they can be connected more than our ancestors to pretty much the rest of the world, do you see in any way merit to the claim that they actually are having to balance a lot more on their shoulders?
With all these ideas available, how do you distinguish between the good science and the bad science? How do you distinguish between what can be proven and what feels right, between the science and the pseudoscience? And that's the challenge. That's the challenge that we live with today.
Richard, I appreciate your perspective on this. We'll sure get some feedback on it and continue the discussion here on the radio. All right.
Thank you very much.
I've got Sierra on Skype. You're on the Thinking Atheist radio podcast. How's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. What are your thoughts on those godless millennials? What do you think?
Well, we've got all the technology and all the facts beside us now. It's so much easier for us to just look at our phones and just Google something to debunk someone's argument in a second, basically.
Is that what you've done? You know, were you formerly religious and you just sort of did some homework or what?
Oh, yeah. I did a ton of homework. I was pretty religious growing up. I went to a Christian school, summer camp, the whole thing. And I graduated 2 years ago from a Christian school. And in those 2 years, I've basically been shaping my mind and my worldview in a whole new way.
So you were still a true blue believer when you graduated from high school?
I just had a loose faith. Like, I was what they call a lukewarm Christian. And it was because I was like a lukewarm with my faith that it was so easy to move away from it.
You just realized it was all a bunch of crap and I'm done.
Yeah, like I found the facts pretty easily, actually. It was just the whole thing of trying to get those facts into my head. That was the hard part for a while, but now it's coming pretty easily.
You think it came easier to you than it might have to your parents because of the generation you were born in?
Yeah, big time. My parents are actually still fairly strongly Christian, and I am still like under their supervision still in a way.
Are you under the radar? Do they know about you?
They just know that I'm questioning things a lot right now, and they're trying to get me back on the path of faith, but that's not what I want. So,
well, I'm not outing you here. I mean, you being on this radio show, your voice is out there. They may recognize it. I doubt they'd stumble upon this conversation, but this is cool, right? You and me talking now?
Yeah, it is.
Mm-hmm. All right. All right.
And one thing, I don't know if this is the norm for a podcast or not, but I did want to get involved further in the atheist community because I have found so many great YouTubers, but you know, talking to creators is still kind of hard. So I want to talk to other people in the community a lot more.
So you're thinking, what can I do to be a part of the conversation?
Yeah. Yeah. My Twitter is @Sierra_LV, all lowercase. And if anyone wants to reach out to me, they can, because I really want to reach out to people. I'm having a tough time getting involved with the smaller communities, so I just want to put my own shout out here, I guess.
Yeah, all right. Well, I'm cool with that. I mean, as long as you see all these, you know, heathens showing up on your Twitter feed, that also appears on your family's radar. I mean, you're not going to be incognito very long. My advice to anybody, though, who says they'd like to be more active is I always find out, you know, I try to encourage them, rather, what are your gifts? What are you passionate about? What are you good at? And try to find a way to make that useful in communicating ideas. So if you are an artist of some kind, if you're a writer, if you're a communicator, if there's some other gift or passion that you have that you're able to do relatively well, I'd say start there. Find a way to maybe translate that into furthering the conversations out there. You doing okay these days?
Yeah, I am. I'm able to do whatever I want on the internet, basically, so they're not, like, looking over my shoulder at all.
All right.
And I am actually starting psychology in college right now, and I'm at a secular college, which I'm so thankful for. The funny thing is, my sister is at a Christian college right now, and she's learning psychology, too, so it would be very weird for us to compare notes and see what exactly our differences are that we learned. And it's kind of tough for me to see my sister still go to a Christian education, because I thought she would go to a secular college, like the same one I did, but she's still in that community 100%. And I'm just learning as much as I can to help her and others in my life.
Hmm. So if someone was to call you a godless millennial, you're okay with that label?
Well, I don't consider myself completely godless yet, honestly. Like, there's still tiny little corners of my mind where I'm like, oh, is God still real, or is, like, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, you're still going through the journey, still asking the questions, still testing the waters. I think that's totally valid. As long as you're taking that journey on your terms, I think it's fantastic, Sierra.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for calling and being a part of the conversation. It's a real honor to be able to chat with you.
Yeah, it's a real honor to get to talk to you.
Coming up after a short break, more of your input about millennials. And I'm going to cap the show, if I can call the last third of the broadcast, capping the broadcast. It's like almost a half an hour long piece. It's an article in Time Magazine from a few years ago by Joel Stein about the millennials that, if you only listen to the first part, will enrage you. That's why I will encourage you to listen to the whole thing. It's an interesting piece, certainly worthy of discussion. I will share that with you. That and a whole lot more right after this. Hang on. September 30th in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the Myth Information Conference is premiering their new film. It's called Batman and Jesus, a feature film that compares ancient mythologies with modern mythologies. It's a red carpet event with many special guests, and you are invited. The film caps the Myth Information Conference itself, which is an event unlike the typical free thought convention. The conference is about dialogue, bringing together diverse speakers, diverse perspectives, diverse attendees to promote reasoned and respectful dialogue about many of the hot topics in the secular community today: politics, religion, social justice, free speech, and more. Agree or disagree, this event is about the sharing of and the challenging of ideas. At MythCon, you're going to see a debate about Islam between atheist Faisal Saeed Al-Muttar and Muslim Asra Nomani. That debate's moderated by Matt Dillahunty. Thomas Smith is going to face off on stage with Sargon of Akkad. Presentations by former Scientologist Ron Miscavige, Melissa Chen, Shoe on Head, and Armored Skeptic from YouTube give their perspectives on skepticism and social media. And of course, the Batman and Jesus film debut and a VIP after party. I will be there, Aaron Raw and other activists will be there, and you can still get your tickets to attend the conference in person or for the live stream if you can't join us there. Get your tickets and all the details for the 2017 Myth Information Conference at mythicistmilwaukee.com. That's mythicistmilwaukee.com. My Patreon supporters get a commercial-free version of this show every single week, and they get a bonus broadcast every single month. And if you'd like to support this broadcast on Patreon, thank you so very much. You can just log on and just choose the amount that you'd like to support with. Go to patreon.com/Seth Andrews. More on today's subject, we're talking about millennials. On the switchboard, I've got area code 423. You are on the Thinking Atheist radio podcast. What's your name?
It's Shane.
Hi, Shane. We're talking about secular millennials and any other topic related to millennials. How old are you, may I ask?
I am 32.
All right. So you qualify. Talk to me. What's your perspective on all this?
Pretty much, you know, I'm born in Northeast Tennessee, and this is pretty much the heartland of Jesus country. And I was raised into a fundamentalist Christian church. It didn't take very long, you know, getting through high school and learning about all the modern sciences and everything, that you start questioning what you've been told.
What's your perspective on millennials and the perspectives about millennials? What do you think?
I do believe that millennials are coming more towards the non-religious. You know, we do tend to be more progressive, more liberal, and the ways of the church isn't really matching what we believe anymore.
How do you feel about the label? How does it make you feel? Do you mind it?
I think it's no big deal. It's just another term for our generation. It does fit because, you know, we brought in the new millennium.
Yeah. Do you feel like sometimes people pigeonhole millennials to be a certain way?
We do tend to be sort of, you know, they call us the snowflakes or the justice warriors and all of that.
Why do you think they call this generation like a snowflake generation? Where do you think that comes from?
I think we tend to be more based on equality. And when something doesn't sound right, we tend to chime in more. You know, the other generations, they're kind of hardened. It was just the way it is.
From that perspective, then, it's possible that people from generations past might have been more like, oh, just suck it up and deal with it. And
yeah.
The millennial generation is more like, well, it's wrong. Let's go change it. Let's fix it. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, the baby boomers kind of have the, well, this is the way it is. Well, no, it's not. It's not right.
All right, Shane, anything else about millennials?
I think that we'll be looked back as a good generation. We're trying to do more for equality. We're trying to be more open to everyone.
I buy that. Shane, I appreciate your perspective for the broadcast very much. Thanks so much for being a part of the show.
All right, thank you.
Daniel sent me a message. He said, I am what some might consider an old millennial. I was born in 1986 in a very conservative area of southeastern Pennsylvania, right in the heart of Amish country. My family attended an evangelical congregational church, which was pretty fundamentalist. I remember growing up defending a literal Bible and a young earth. I also remember falling asleep listening to the soothing voice of Dawson McAllister. A quick Google search tells me that his show is still on the air. How is that possible? As a teen, I was trained in apologetics. I carried around Josh McDowell's Evidence That Demands a Verdict. And I attended Sun Life's SEMP conference, the students equipped to minister to peers more than once. There we learned cold contact street evangelism. It was terrifying and I hated it, but I had to do it if I wanted to be on my youth group's ministry team. Ironically, through all this, I had a very strong interest in science. Somehow I managed to learn and enjoy science, while ignoring all the things that didn't jive with my fundamentalist upbringing. I dared to allow myself to believe that the Genesis account probably took thousands of years instead of six literal days. That progressed into believing in intelligent design and theistic evolution, but I always made room for God. When I went to college, I decided to major in molecular biology. Two things happened while I was at college, which, looking back, contributed significantly to my atheism. First, I started to meet people of different races, religions, sexual orientations, and gender identities. Some of these people I cared very deeply for, and I had trouble reconciling this with my upbringing, which taught me to outgroup people. Second, I took a class called The Bible as Literature. A significant portion of this class focused on the Old Testament, and I came face to face with just how crazy the book is. This is a big reason why I think millennials are less religious than previous generations. We're the most educated generation to date. We have access to the gamut of mankind's knowledge on our phones. The modern church of the 90s and 2000s doesn't make any sense with the experiences and lessons we learned pursuing higher education, and we've left the church in droves. After college and during graduate school, I tried to force myself to go to church, but there was always something about the dogma of each church I went to that bothered me. I told myself it was my fault. I reread Brian McLaren's A Generous Orthodoxy. It didn't work. Before my daughter was born in 2013, my wife and I forced ourselves to go to church. We thought that our daughter would need that community, and so we drug ourselves there. For the better part of 2 years, we went as much as we could. The church embraced us as family, and they treated us very well. But every week, I felt more and more like I was just singing and praying to the ceiling. I came to grips with my non-belief around November of 2015. My son was due in January, and I couldn't pretend anymore. I came out as an atheist to my wife during the 8-hour drive to visit our family for Thanksgiving. After the initial shock, I was pretending to be this rock for my family for so long. We talked, and it turns out we both felt the same way. 2 years later, we're happy atheist parents, raising two happy atheist kids who don't think they're going to go to hell just because they told a lie. I look back on my days in the faith mostly with disdain. I said some really mean things to people for what I thought were righteous reasons. With more education and experience under my belt, I've realized the error of my ways. I'm more loving and accepting as an atheist than I ever was as a Christian. Your show has meant a lot to me. Your talks and podcast episodes on Christian culture hit a little too close to home. I can laugh about it now, but I remember being really excited to watch the Newsboys live at Creation Fest. Keep up the good work, Dan. Dan, I appreciate it very much. Yeah, it hits close to home for me too sometimes. think about some of the stuff we used to do and say and look forward to and practice in when we were growing up as religious people. And sometimes you just cringe, you know. I totally get it. I've got Carrie on Skype. You're on the Thinking Atheist radio podcast. How's it going?
Pretty good, Seth. How are you doing?
I'm well. I feel old, though, talking about all these youngsters, all these millennials. Yeah. How old are you, Carrie?
19.
Oh, see, it continues. I've got shoes older than you, Carrie. I'm just saying. We're talking about millennials. Do you have a perspective on this generation? What do you want to say?
I hate my generation. I absolutely hate it. I hate being called a millennial. It's absolutely brutal.
Now, hang on. Hold on. Do you hate the label or do you hate being a part of the culture?
Both.
Spell it out for me. What's that about?
Why I hate the label first is because it's used almost in a derogatory context a lot of the time when I hear it. So you hear, oh, those damn millennials, they're doing this, they're doing that. It's just like, could you not? Like, please. So annoying.
Don't pigeonhole us. Don't stereotype us.
Exactly.
That's what you're thinking.
Exactly.
Okay. But what about the generation makes you crazy then?
Just how they act. They don't act like normal people. It's like I'm raised in a household where if you don't act like a normal human, you don't fit into society. Like, okay, you have to be like on the ball, like just keep running. You see something in your way, just blow through it.
Okay, hang on. Let me make sure I understand you, Carrie. So you come from a family of go-getters. In your own culture, you guys have to go out, make things happen, solve problems, live a proactive life, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But you don't see many others in your age bracket as having those qualities?
Yeah. A lot of them, it's all mommy's money, daddy's money. Oh, mom paid for this, dad paid for that. Oh, I got this from my aunt, got this from family, da-da-da-da-da. It's all the same anymore.
So in that sense, if they're talking about millennials in a derogatory way, you feel it would fit? I mean, I don't know.
It doesn't fit me personally. Like, okay, other people, I can see it, like, clear as day.
Well, what's your experience? Are we talking about people who you went to school with or current friends, neighbors, so what?
A lot of people, like friends, family, just kids I went to school with, strangers that are my age, and I'm just like, I just look at them and I go, yeah, you fit that label. Me, no.
All right. Well, Carrie, I appreciate your honesty on the show, and, you know, I hope at some point your generation frustrates you less, and I appreciate you listening and being a part of the conversation.
I appreciate it, too.
I have area code 814. You are on the Thinking Atheist radio podcast. Tell me your name.
Kathy.
Hi, Kathy. We're talking about millennials. Do you have any thoughts on the matter?
Oh, yes, I do. I love the millennials. I have two of them myself. I guess that might make me a little less objective, but I think they're really fantastic people.
Well, qualify that for me. Give me some specifics. Why?
I'm wildly impressed with their open-mindedness. They really question everything. I attribute that to the internet, of course, because they have exposure to so very much of what's going on in the world right now and different ideas and so, you know, just all that. And my own daughters and the ones that I have worked with tend to not just take things at face value. They want to know why. They want to know, why do we do it that way? Isn't there a better way? They don't give respect as easily, but they give tons of it if you've earned it. They're just great, great people.
Do you ever envy them? Do you ever wish you'd been a little bit more like that when you were growing up?
No, because I was somewhat, not as much as they are. What I envy them is the access to the world that they have that I didn't have. I came of age in the early 70s, you know. It was a different world then.
We sound like our parents, don't we, when we're talking, these kids today have so much stuff they take for granted. Yeah.
I don't think they take it for granted, though. They do in a sense, of course, because they've always had it. But when I talk with my kids about the differences in things and the young people I've worked with, they question what it was like. They want to know. They're sincerely interested. And then they look around and go, yeah, this is good right now. This is good.
I was having a conversation with someone trying to explain to them what it was like to have to wait an hour to bake a potato in the oven because there were no microwaves. And they're like, what? And if somebody was on the phone, there was no call waiting. You know, you just heard the busy signal and you had to wait helpless. There was no caller ID, so people could prank call you all day and night. You couldn't trace them unless you call the phone company. And if you needed basic information, you get in the car, you drive down to the library using microfiche, and you're checking out books and Xeroxing at a dime a copy. And they looked at me like I was from Mars. They just like, what? What kind of a world are you from? How did you survive?
One of my good friends is, he's 28 now, but that is a 16-year-old working with me. And we had a fun conversation one day about telephones, because when I was a kid, there was still an operator.
Oh, my goodness.
The phones were tied to the wall. You couldn't go far with them.
Dial zero for the operator and say, I would like you to connect me to something.
Yes. Yeah. I was just a little girl, but I still remember my phone number, for heaven's sakes. But and now we're walking around with computers in our pockets, and nobody had a vague concept of a computer at the time.
I can't imagine, though, to a degree that young people don't. I mean, they have to take a little bit of it for granted because they're so used to it. It's always been there. And
yes, it always has.
And I'm glad it's been there. I honestly, I envy them in so many ways, don't you? It's like, if only I had had these resources when I was 12, 15, whatever, right?
And when you bring it to their attention, they do appreciate it. Now, obviously, not every single millennial, well, can't group them all like that, but I have found that they just are a good bunch of people overall.
Talk to me about parenthood in regard to a millennial. And there are still some who are blanching as I use the label, but I made it the title of the show. It's an attention getter. Right. It helps me frame the conversation. Just everybody go with me on this, okay? But there's a narrative out there that says that the parents of millennials coddled them, made them the center of the universe. Everything revolved around them, solved all their problems, essentially just ill-prepared them for the world. You want to speak to that?
Oh, well, I suppose some did. I've seen some of that, but in my own family, I've got a 33-year-old and a 23-year-old, and they didn't get coddled at all. Times were tough, and they knew it. They went to work young. They worked hard. They didn't take anything for granted they had growing up, because there wasn't a lot of it. And what they had, they saw that it was hard work for. So no, they weren't coddled. And I think that the obvious, you look around and you see the ones that obviously were, and they're the ones that stand out, that's all.
And our generation had its share of people who sort of fit the same description, didn't they?
Sure. I mean, like the quote, it goes all the way back to Socrates, you know, and probably further when it comes to that.
Talking about human nature.
Yeah, the situation is different, but the people are the same. Only I think the millennials, they're more aware of the world rather than just their local area.
Yeah, I buy that. Do you want to speak to religiosity? I mean, how'd you address religion in your home?
Both of my kids are atheists with no prompting whatsoever from me.
Well, how'd you do that?
I was raised Catholic. I went to a Catholic school through eighth grade. But I never have a lot of time for religion. At first, I separated the church from the actual belief in God because the politics of the church pissed me off no end. Birth control, when you grow a vagina, you can tell me what I can do with mine, right? I'm sorry, but a bunch of old men in skirts aren't going to tell me how many kids I can or can't have.
And you know what? If one of those guys grows a vagina, we're going to the circus. We're gonna make some money or something. We're calling. We're gonna call somebody, you know, and have this occasion marked.
But I never had a lot of time for church going. I didn't force them to go to church. They have different fathers. The one's father became religious when she was a teenager, and she was like, what? And the other one's father, his whole family just could have cared less one way or the other. So, but she's the younger one, spent a lot of time in the Assemblies of God church because I was a single mom and her babysitter belonged to that. And she came home one day very ticked off. Was about the time that the Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire was released. And we were very much into those books. I'd read to her every night. And she overheard the pastor of the church telling another adult that he had read the first two and thought they were really good books. But then the church came, handed down the edict that it's evil. And so he wasn't going to read anymore. And he was going to tell his whole, you know, bad stuff. And she was so pissed off at the hypocrisy in that. I think, yeah. And she must have been, oh, I don't remember what year Goblet came out, but she must have been 10 or 11. And that just set her on the questioning, yeah.
She was observant enough to be able to see it right in front of her face. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Oh, they're smart kids, of course. Yeah.
Oh, well, good genes, good stock, yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, it's refreshing. It's awesome to hear a parent talk so positively about her children, her quote-unquote millennial children. I'm excited for you. I'm excited for them. More free thinkers, more people out there who are about positive change and about being rationalists. And that's just awesome stuff.
I hope there is. I came into adulthood with the notion that I was not going to be like the adults in my life that seemed to forget that they had been teenagers and young people once. Oh, it's just puppy love. Oh, you think you've got problems now? Wait till you grow up. All that kind of stuff really ticked me off. So coming into adulthood and being a parent, I tried to remember, yeah, it might be only puppy love, but it hurts like hell when you're 14 or 15, doesn't it?
That's an interesting angle.
Yeah.
You know,
and the problems you have at that age are the problems that you are capable of coping with. It might be trivial to an adult, but that's where you're at in your learning curve, your growing curve. You know?
I think it also speaks to the idea that, you know, adults so often discount heartbreak based on an age bracket when hearts can be broken, you know, at the earliest of ages. And they don't take into account the tremendous amount of pressures that many people feel as they are students and trying to develop relationships and learning about the world.
Yeah.
And so when an adult says, oh, you're young, you don't know anything, it doesn't make any difference. One day, you know, call me when you're 21 and we'll talk. I find that tragic.
Yeah.
That's tragic. So
That's awful.
Well, you sound like a fantastic mom, and I'm happy for you and your kids. So I appreciate your perspective on the show, and all my best with you and yours, okay?
Thanks.
I want to cap the show, if I may, with a long article that was printed in Time magazine 4 years ago. The article written by Joel Stein, it was titled, Millennials, the Me Generation. Now, I want you to stick with me here, okay? Especially if you are a millennial that blanches at the brand and the stereotypes. Because you're going to think you know where Joel Stein is going, and you might be wrong. It's a long article to read, going to take me probably close to a half an hour. But I think it's content heavy enough to warrant the time, and certainly provides food for further thought and conversation on the subject of millennials. Again, it's called Millennials, the Me Generation. Joel Stein, Time Magazine, May of 2013. It reads like this. I'm about to do what old people have done throughout history. Call those younger than me lazy, entitled, selfish, and shallow. But I have studies. I have statistics. I have quotes from respected academics. Unlike my parents, my grandparents, and my great-grandparents, I have proof. Here's the cold hard data. The incidence of narcissistic personality disorder is nearly 3 times as high for people in their 20s as for the generation that's now 65 or older, according to the National Institutes of Health. 58% more college students scored higher on a narcissism scale in 2009 than in 1982. Millennials got so many participation trophies growing up that a recent study showed that 40% believe they should be promoted every 2 years, regardless of performance. They are fame-obsessed, Three times as many middle school girls want to grow up to be a personal assistant to a famous person as want to be a senator, according to a 2007 survey. Four times as many would pick the assistant job over CEO of a major corporation. They're so convinced of their own greatness that the National Study of Youth and Religion found the guiding morality of 60% of millennials in any situation is that they'll just be able to feel what's right. Their development is stunted. More people ages 18 to 29 live with their parents than with a spouse, according to the 2017 Clark University poll of emerging adults, and they are lazy. In 1992, the nonprofit Families and Work Institute reported that 80% of people under 23 wanted to one day have a job with greater responsibility. 10 years later, only 60% did. Millennials consist, depending on who you ask, of people born from 1980 to 2000. To put it more simply for them, since they grew up not having to do a lot of math in their heads, thanks to computers, the group is made up mostly of teens and 20-somethings. At 80 million strong, they are the biggest age grouping in American history. Each country's millennials are different, but because of globalization, social media, the exporting of Western culture, and the speed of change, millennials worldwide are more similar to one another than to older generations within their nations. Even in China, where family history is more important than any individual, the internet, urbanization, and the one-child policy have created a generation as overconfident and self-involved as the Western one. And these aren't just rich kid problems. Poor millennials have even higher rates of narcissism, materialism, and technology addiction in their ghetto fabulous lives. They are the most threatening and exciting generation since the baby boomers brought about social revolution, not because they're trying to take over the establishment, but because they're growing up without one. The Industrial Revolution made individuals far more powerful. They could move to a city, start a business, read and form organizations. The information revolution has further empowered individuals by handing them the technology to compete against huge organizations, hackers versus corporations, bloggers versus newspapers, terrorists versus nation states, YouTube directors versus studios, app makers versus entire industries. Millennials don't need us. That's why we're scared of them. In the U.S., millennials are the children of baby boomers, who are also known as the me generation, who then produced the me generation, whose selfishness technology has only exacerbated. Whereas in the 1950s, families displayed a wedding photo, a school photo, and maybe a military photo in their homes, the average middle-class American family today walks amid 85 pictures of themselves and their pets. Millennials have come of age in the era of the quantified self, recording their daily steps on Fitbit, their whereabouts every hour of every day on PlaceMe, and their genetic data on 23andMe. They have less civic engagement and lower political participation than any previous group. This is a generation that would have made Walt Whitman wonder if maybe they should try singing a song of someone else. Joel Stein continues, they got this way partly because in the 1970s, people wanted to improve kids' chances of success by instilling self-esteem. It turns out that self-esteem is great for getting a job or hooking up at a bar, but not so great for keeping a job or a relationship. It was an honest mistake, says Roy Baumeister, a psychology professor at Florida State University and the editor of Self-Esteem, The Puzzle of Low Self-Regard. The early findings showed that indeed kids with high self-esteem did better in school and were less likely to be in various kinds of trouble. It's just that we've learned later that self-esteem is a result, not a cause. The problem is when people try to boost self-esteem, they accidentally boost narcissism instead. Just tell your kids you love them. It's a better message, says Gene Twenge, a psychology professor at San Diego State University, who wrote Generation Me and the Narcissism Epidemic. When they're little, it seems cute to tell them they're special or a princess or a rock star or whatever their t-shirt says. When they're 14, it's no longer cute. All that self-esteem leads them to be disappointed when the world refuses to affirm how great they know they are. This generation has the highest likelihood of having unmet expectations with respect to their careers and the lowest levels of satisfaction with their careers at the stage that they're at, said Sean Lyons, co-editor of Managing the New Workforce. It's sort of a crisis of unmet expectation. What millennials are most famous for, besides narcissism, is its effect: entitlement. If you want to sell seminars to middle managers, make them about how to deal with young employees who email the CEO directly and beg off projects they find boring. English teacher David McCullough Jr.'s address last year to Wellesley High School's graduating class, a 12-minute reality check called You Are Not Special, has nearly 2 million hits on YouTube. Climb the mountain so you can see the world, not so the world can see you, McCullough told the graduates. He says nearly all the response to the video has been positive, especially from millennials themselves. The video has 57 likes for every dislike. I'll continue reading here. He says, though they're cocky about their place in the world, millennials are also stunted. Having prolonged a life stage between teenager and adult that this magazine once called Twixters, and will now use once again in an attempt to get that term to catch on. The idea of a teenager started in the 1920s. In 1910, only a tiny percentage of kids went to high school, so most people's social interactions were with adults in their family or in the workplace. Now that cell phones allow kids to socialize at every hour, they send and receive an average of 88 texts a day, according to Pew. They are living under the constant influence of their friends. Peer pressure is anti-intellectual, it is anti-historical, it's anti-eloquence, says Mark Berline, an English professor at Emory. He wrote The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future. Never before in history have people been able to grow up and reach age 23 so dominated by peers. To develop intellectually, you've got to relate to older people, older things. 17-year-olds never grow up if they're just hanging around other 17-year-olds. Of all the objections to Obamacare, not a lot of people argued against parents' need to cover their kids' health insurance until they're 26. Millennials are interacting all day, but almost entirely through a screen. You've seen them at bars, sitting next to one another and texting. They might look calm, but they're deeply anxious about missing out on something better. 70% of them check their phones every hour, and many experience phantom pocket vibration syndrome. They're doing a behavior to reduce their anxiety, says Larry Rosen, a psychology professor at California State and the author of Eye Disorder. That constant search for a hit of dopamine, someone liked my status update, reduces creativity. From 1966, when the Torrance test of creative thinking were first administered, through the mid-1980s, creativity scores in children increased. Then they dropped, falling sharply in 1998. Scores on test of empathy similarly fell sharply starting in 2000, likely because of both a lack of face-to-face time and higher degrees of narcissism. Not only do millennials lack the kind of empathy that allows them to feel concerned for others, but they also have trouble even intellectually understanding others' points of view. What they do understand is how to turn themselves into brands with friend and follower tallies that serve as sales figures. As with most sales, positivity and confidence work best. People are inflating themselves like balloons on Facebook, says W. Keith Campbell, psychology professor at the University of Georgia. He's written 3 books about generational increases in narcissism. When everyone's telling you about their vacations, parties, and promotions, you start to embellish your own life to keep up. If you do this well enough on Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter, you can become a micro-celebrity. Millennials grew up watching reality TV shows, most of which are basically documentaries about narcissists. And now they've trained themselves to be reality TV ready. Most people never define who they are as a personality type until their 30s. So for people to be defining who they are at the age of 14 is almost a huge evolutionary jump, says casting director Doron Ophir. To audition participants for Jersey Shore, Millionaire Matchmaker, A Shot at Love, and RuPaul's Drag Race, among others. Do you follow me on Twitter? He asked at the end of the interview. Oh, you should. I'm fun. I hope that one day they provide an Emmy for casting of reality shows, because, you know, I'd assume I'm a shoe-in. I would like that gold statue. And then I'll take a photo of it, and then I will Instagram it. Ophir is 41, but he's clearly spent a lot of time around millennials. I've gone just about as far as I can in an article without talking about myself. Joel Stein says, so yes, I'm aware I started this piece with the word I. The piece in which I complain about millennials' narcissism. I know that this magazine, which for decades did not print bylines, started putting authors' names on the cover regularly in 2004, and that one of the first names was mine. As I mocked reality shows in the previous paragraph, I kept thinking about the fact that I got to the final round for 1995's Real World London. I know my number of Twitter followers far better than the tally on my car's odometer. Although Facebook has a strictly enforced limit of 5,000 friends, I somehow have 5,079. It was impossible not to remember, the whole time I was accusing millennials of being lazy, that I was supposed to finish this article nearly a year ago. Joel Stein says, I moved home for the first 6 months after college. When I got hired at Time, my coworkers hated me for cozying up to the editor of the magazine. I talk to one of my parents every other day and depend on my dad for financial advice. It's highly possible I'm a particularly lame 41-year-old, but still, none of these traits are new to millennials. They've been around at least since the Reformation. When Martin Luther told Christians they didn't need the church to talk to God, and became more pronounced at the end of the 18th century in the Romantic period, when artists stopped using their work to celebrate God and started using it to express themselves. In 1979, Christopher Lash wrote in The Culture of Narcissism, quote, the media give substance to and thus intensify narcissistic dreams of fame and glory, encourage common people to identify themselves with the stars and to hate the herd, and make it more and more difficult for them to accept the banality of everyday existence. I checked my email 3 times during that sentence. So while the entire first half of this article is absolutely true, I had data. Millennial self-involvement is more a continuation of a trend than a revolutionary break from previous generations. They're not a new species. They've just mutated to adapt to their environment. For example, millennials' perceived entitlement isn't a result of overprotection, but an adaptation to a world of abundance. For almost all of human history, almost everyone was a small-scale farmer. And then people were farmers and factory workers. Nobody gets very much fulfillment from either of those things, says Jeffrey Arnett, psychology professor at Clark University. He invented the phrase emerging adulthood, which people foolishly use instead of the catchy Twixters. Twixters put off life choices because they can choose from a huge array of career options, some of which, like jobs in social media, didn't exist 10 years ago. What idiot would try to work her way up at a company when she's going to have an average of 7 jobs before the age of 26? Because of online dating, Facebook circles, and the ability to connect with people internationally, they no longer have to marry someone from their high school class or even their home country. Because life expectancy is increasing so rapidly, and technology allows women to get pregnant in their 40s, they're more free to postpone big decisions. The median age for American women's first marriage went up from 20.6 in 1967 to 26.9 in 2011, almost 27 years old. And while all that choice might end in disappointment, it's a lottery worth playing. I had one grandfather fight in the Pacific and one in the Atlantic Theater. One became a pilot, one became a doctor. When you grow up during the Great Depression and fight off the Nazis, you want safety and stability, says Tucker Max, 37, who set an example for millennials when instead of using his Duke law degree to practice law, he took his blog rants about his drunken, lecherous adventures and turned them into a mega best-selling book, I Hope They Serve Beer in Hell, that he got an independent publisher to print. Everyone told you that everyone above you had to shit on you before you got to shit on people below you, and millennials don't want to do that, he says. In fact, a lot of what counts as typical millennial behavior is how rich kids have always behaved.
The internet has democratized opportunity for many people, giving them access and information that once belonged mostly to the wealthy. Joel Stein says, when I was growing up in the 1980s, I thought I'd be a lawyer, since that was the best option I knew about for people who sucked at math in my middle-class suburb. But I saw a lot more options since I got to Stanford. Previously, if you wanted to be a writer but didn't know anyone who was in publishing, it was just, well, I won't write. But now it's, wait, I know someone who knows someone, says Jane Buckingham, who studies workplace changes as founder of Trendera, a consumer insights firm. I hear story after story of people high up in an organization saying, well, this person just emailed me and asked me for an hour of my time, and for whatever reason, I gave it to them. So the great thing is that they do feel entitled to all this, so they'll be more innovative and more willing to try new things, and they'll do all this cool stuff. Because millennials don't respect authority, they also don't resent it. That's why they're the first teens who aren't rebelling. They're not even sullen. I grew up watching Peanuts, where you didn't even see the parents. They were just the wah-wah voice. And MTV was always a parent-free zone, says MTV President Stephen Friedman, 43, who now includes parents in nearly all the channel's reality shows. One of our research studies early on said that a lot of this audience outsources their superego to their parents. The most simple decision of should I do this or should I do that, our audience will check in with their parents. A 2012 Google Chrome ad shows a college student video chatting all the details of her life to her dad. I'm very used to seeing things where the cliche is that the parent doesn't understand. Most of my friends, their parents are on social, and they're following them or sharing stuff with them, said Jessica Brillhart, a filmmaker at Google's Creative Lab who worked on the commercial. It's hard to hate your parents when they also listen to rap and watch Jon Stewart. In fact, many parents of millennials would proudly call their child-rearing style parenting. I negotiate daily with my son, who's 13. Maybe all that coddling is paid off in these parent-child relationships, says John Murray. He created The Real World and other reality shows. He says that seeing regular people celebrated on TV gives millennials confidence. They're going after what they want. It can be a little irritating when they want to be on the next rung so quickly. Maybe I'm partly responsible for it. I like this generation, so I have no issues with that. Kim Kardashian, who represents to non-millennials all that is wrong with her generation, readily admits that she has no particular talent, but she also knows why she appeals to her peers. They like that I share a lot of myself and that I've always been honest about the way I live my life, she says. They want relationships with businesses and celebrities. Gen X was kept at arm's length from businesses and celebrity. When you're no longer cowed by power, you're going to like what a friend tells you about far more than what an ad campaign does, even if that friend is a celebrity trying to make money and the friendship is just a reply to a tweet. While every millennial might seem like an oversharing Kardashian, posting vacation photos on Facebook is actually less obnoxious. The 1960s couples trapping friends in their houses to watch their terrible vacation slideshows. Can you imagine if the boomers had YouTube, how narcissistic they would have seemed? Asked Scott Hess, Senior Vice President of Human Intelligence for Spark SMG, whose TEDx speech entitled Millennials, Who They Are and Why We Hate Them, advised companies on marketing to youth. Can you imagine how many freaking Instagrams of people playing in the mud during Woodstock we would have seen? I think in many ways you're blaming millennials for the technology that happens to exist right now. Yes, they check their phones during class. But think about how long you can stand in line without looking at your phone. Now imagine being used to that technology your whole life and having to sit through algebra. Companies are starting to adjust not just to millennials' habits, but also their atmospheric expectations. Nearly a quarter of DreamWorks' 2,200 employees are under 30, and the studio has a 96% retention rate. Dan Satherwaite, who runs the studio's human relations department, and he's been in the field for about 23 years, says Maslow's hierarchy of needs makes it clear that a company can't just provide money anymore, but also has to deliver self-actualization. During work hours at DreamWorks, you can take classes in photography, sculpting, painting, cinematography, and karate. When one employee explained that jujitsu is totally different from karate, Satterwaith was shocked at his boldness. Then he added a jujitsu class. Millennials are able to use their leverage to negotiate much better contracts with the traditional institutions they do still join. Although the armed forces had to lower the physical standards for recruits and make boot camp less intensive, Gary Styler, who's been an Army recruiter for about 15 years, is otherwise more impressed with millennials than any other group he's worked with. Quote, "The generation that we enlisted when I first started recruiting was sort of do, do, do. This generation is think about it before you do it," he says. "This generation is 3 to 4 steps ahead. They're coming in saying, I want to do this, and then when I'm done with this, I want to do this." Here's something even all the psychologists who fret over their narcissism studies agree about. Millennials are nice. They have none of that David Letterman irony and Gen X ennui. The positivism has surprised me. The internet was always 50-50 positive and negative, and now it's 90-10, says Shane Smith, the 43-year-old CEO of Vice, which adjusted from being a Gen X company in print to a millennial company once it started posting videos online, which are viewed by a much younger audience. Millennials are more accepting of differences, not just among gays, women, and minorities, but in everyone. There are many, many subcultures, and you can dip into them and search around. I prefer that to you're either super mainstream or a riot girl, says Tabby Gevinson, a 17-year-old who runs Rookie, an online fashion magazine, from her bedroom when she's not in school. It's hard, in other words, to join the counterculture when there's no culture. There's not this us versus them thing now. Maybe that's why millennials don't rebel, she says. There may even be the beginning of a reaction against all the constant self-promotion. Even Spiegel, 22, co-founder of Snapchat, an app that allows people to send photos, video, and text permanently erased after 10 seconds or less, argues that it's become too exhausting for millennials to front a perfect life on social media. We're trying to create a place where you can be in sweatpants, sitting, eating cereal on a Friday night, and that's okay, he says. But if you need the ultimate proof that millennials could be a great force for positive change, know this. Tom Brokaw, champion of the greatest generation, loves millennials. He calls them the wary generation. And he thinks their cautiousness in life decisions is a smart response to their world. Quote, "Their great mantra has been challenge convention, find new and better ways of doing things. And so that ethos transcends the wonky people who are inventing new apps and embraces the whole economy," he says. The generation that experienced Monica Lewinsky's dress, 9/11, the longest wars in U.S. history, the Great Recession, and an Arab Spring that looks at best like a late winter, is nevertheless optimistic about its own personal chances of success. Sure, it might be delusional, but it's got to lead to better results than wearing flannel, complaining, and making indie movies about it. So here's a more rounded picture of millennials than the one I started with, Joel Stein says, all of which I have data for. They're earnest and optimistic. They embrace the system. They're pragmatic idealists, tinkerers more than dreamers, life hackers. Their world is so flat that they have no leaders, which is why revolutions from Occupy Wall Street to Tahrir Square have even less chance than previous rebellions. They want constant approval. They post photos from the dressing room as they try on clothes. They have massive fear of missing out and have an acronym for everything. They're celebrity obsessed, but don't respectfully idolize celebrities from a distance. They're not into going to church, even though they believe in God, because they don't identify with big institutions. 1/3 of adults under 30, the highest percentage ever, are religiously unaffiliated. They want new experiences, which are more important to them than material goods. They're cool and reserved and not all that passionate. They're informed but inactive. They hate Joseph Kony, but they're not going to do anything about Joseph Kony. They're pro-business. They're financially responsible. Although student loans have hit record highs, they have less household and credit card debt than any previous generation on record, which admittedly isn't that hard when you're living at home and using your parents' credit card. They love their phones, but hate talking on them. They're not only the biggest generation we've ever known, but maybe the last large birth grouping that will be easy to generalize about. There are already micro-generations within the millennial group, launching as often as new iPhones, depending on whether you learn to type before Facebook, Twitter, iPads, or Snapchat. Those rising micro-generations are all horrifying the ones right above them, who are their siblings. And the group after millennials is likely to be even more empowered. They're already so comfortable in front of the camera that the average American one-year-old has more images of himself than a 17th century French king. So yes, we have all that data about narcissism and laziness and entitlement, but a generation's greatness isn't determined by data. It's determined by how they react to the challenges that befall them. And just as important, by how we react to them. Whether you think millennials are the new greatest generation of optimistic entrepreneurs, or a group of 80 million people about to implode in a dwarf star of tears when their expectations are unmet, depends largely on how you view change. Me, I choose to believe in the children. God knows they do. And again, this long article from Time Magazine, May 2013, by Joel Stein, I will link it in the description box of this broadcast. I'll see you back here for some Ark Encounter next week. Have a wonderful week. Thanks for listening. I'll see you soon, okay?
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.